When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Hello and welcome to Eureka, the show that gets under the skin of science as we invite a new expert every week to help us answer one of science's most interesting questions. Isaac Asimov once said, the most exciting phrase in science is not Eureka, but that's funny. We think you can have a bit of both, Isaac. I'm Rick Edwards.
And I'm Dr. Michael Brooks.
Now, usually around this time, of course, I remind everyone that you are not a real doctor. But I think for the first time, and probably the last time, your doctorship actually holds a bit of weight this week.
What, because we're actually going to talk about sort of breaking the laws of physics? And that first and last time thing is absolute horseshit, by the way, because there's loads of stuff we do where actually, you know, having a PhD in physics does give me a little bit of weight. I mean, yeah, let's okay. Talk about that sleep episode we did where your only qualification was that you have to get up early.
Really early, though. So.
No, but today you're right, because we're talking about space flight, where basically physics is king. Or queen, well, or whatever.
I mean, you haven't asked me, but I do fancy a rocket trip into space. I mean, I say that.
Would you, though?
Of course not.
You wouldn't?
No, not for me. No.
Even if it was free? I'm not going on Branson's rocket, by the way. I mean, that's bullshit, but...
Well, because that basically just
Bezos,
is like a high... That's just a high plane.
Yeah.
Would I go if it was free?
Go and look at the Earth from space.
The end point, I'm quite interested in. I would like to see the old blue dot, but I hate the thought of the actual journey. Like, I wouldn't skydive. I wouldn't do a bungee.
Full stop, you wouldn't skydive.
I wouldn't skydive. I wouldn't do a bungee jump. I'm a pussy. Like, I don't...
Absolutely risk averse.
Also, you've got to bear in mind, I was 7 when Challenger exploded.
Okay.
And it made quite an impact on me.
Did it?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I was like, that shit can go wrong. Also, you've seen loads of footage of these fucking rockets going up and then tilting over and then smack. Like,
I know. I mean, I would actually worry just about feeling really sick for the whole thing, which is...
Well, you would definitely feel sick.
It's what happens. I definitely would. Do you know, I once turned down a trip on the zero gravity flight.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was offered a place on that, but I was offered it the week after I'd been to the fairground and I got really sick at the fairground.
Sick on the waltzer.
Yeah, basically on the waltzer. And then I just saw...
Just a horrible man just picking on you, like spinning
faster.
It, spinning
you scream if you want to go faster. You're not screaming. I'm doing it anyway. And so it was the week after and I was still in the like, I don't ever want to feel like that ever again. And because they call it the vomit comet, I was like, no thanks. And that's one of the biggest regrets of my life. I should have just done it.
Yeah, see, I think I maybe would do that.
But I think if I was on a rocket and, like, you know, you're plugged in, it's taking off, and suddenly you're feeling really, really sick. Obviously, you're not asking to get off or whatever. You just got to tolerate it. And, you know, lots of astronauts get space sick, even if they've been, you know, test pilots and stuff. But they get used to it over the sort of course of lots of flights. Whereas if you've only got one flight and you're just going to make the whole thing nauseous...
Yeah.
I'm not keen.
Being sick, not great. Fundamentally, I'm just going to shit myself. Like I am. Like, it's like, it's absolutely terrifying.
Well, just because of the acceleration?
The
potential for it blowing up
is
your thing.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't fancy sitting on a like massive amount of rocket fuel that's just being ignited underneath you.
No, I don't.
Not even for the end product, which is most likely, statistically, you're going to be all right. and you get to see Earth from space.
The end product, I think, would be fantastic. I'm not denying that. I just can't. What about, because there is, the, maybe we'll talk about this, I don't know, but you can get, well, you might be able to get these sort of balloons where you just sort of float up.
Float up to the edge of space.
To the edge of space. That I might have a go at.
Okay.
That seems quite serene and sedate. Yeah. And maybe there's less that can go wrong. I think there probably is less.
No,
I think there is less.
Have you ever been in a hot air balloon?
Yeah.
Yeah, the one I went in crashed.
Okay, fuck the balloon as well.
We had a very bad crash landing. It was terrifying.
Where were you?
Somewhere down in Sussex. And the guy just lost control of it. And the wind, I don't know, the wind got up or something. And we ended up sort of being dragged across a field in the basket, you know, all like lumped on top of one another.
Wow.
Yeah, it wasn't great.
No, that's not great. No, I've been up a couple of times and they're pretty, yeah.
It's nice when it works. It's
very nice, yeah.
Yeah, but you're still a long way up. I mean, I even have that thing now when I get on a flight and it just takes off, the thing that crosses my mind is, well, this is a ridiculously stupid idea.
Yeah.
And then I just have to put that out of my mind. And it's like,
everyone thinks
yeah,
that.
I hope so. I don't know.
You sort of look at the plane and think, yeah, I actually do understand the physics of this, but I still don't trust it particularly.
Yeah.
I went in a stunt plane, a Red Bull stunt plane. Oh, you know, the Red Bull air race.
Yeah.
And that was unacceptable. Because there, the whole thing was they sort of had a camera on my face, and the guy's
looking for this footage straight after
the guy's. The guy's just enjoying himself, the pilot, and so he's doing stuff like this tiny, it's a 2-seater plane,
yeah.
And we're sort of going along, and we're at I don't even know how high, probably I guess like 15,000 feet, like not super high, but high enough,
yeah.
And he's like, right then, let's cut the engine. Cuts the engine. We're just plummeting to the ground.
Yeah. Gravity's incredibly strong, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm just thinking, well, this is awful. This is and the guy's like maniacally laughing, of course, he's loving it. And then he starts again, off we go, and then he's doing loop-the-loops. Loop-the-loops, actually, weirdly, in a plane like that, sort of fine, because it's they're quite slow. Like, you can't do like a tight loop-the-loop, so it's sort of gradual, and it kind of, like, that's all right. Barrel rolls, where you're sort of spinning on the...
On the forward axis.
On the forward axis. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I don't think I've ever felt sicker without actually being sick.
All right.
Hideous. Absolutely hideous.
So I'm thinking that maybe space flight is not for you.
It's not for me.
No.
It's not for
me. No.
Very happy to talk about it. Don't want to get on the flight.
All right. Fair enough.
Thank you. Before we learn how to domesticate animals like horses and donkeys, our only method of transport was walking or running. And it's fair to say we've come a pretty long way since then.
In the year 2000, I think I'll probably be the spaceship to the moon dictating to robots.
We've had unicycles, rollerblades, canoes, hot air balloons, as well as the slightly more impressive advancements like cars, planes and rockets. Our world is feeling smaller and smaller as we're travelling further than ever to more remote places than humans ever imagined would be possible.
3, 2, 1... 0. Liftoff. We have a liftoff.
But we've all got a limited amount of time, and how far we can go depends on how fast we can do it. What possibilities could increasing our speed unlock? That's why this week we're asking, what's the fastest we'll ever be able to travel?
And of course, we have an expert to help us answer this question. And basically, we've got, I think, probably the perfect person for this. We'll be speaking with Sabine Hossenfelder, who's a research fellow at the Frankfurt Institute for Advanced Studies. And I was very excited to speak to Sabine because, A, I love her YouTube channel.
I was going to say it's good.
It is really good.
Yeah.
She's really good. She just explains really fascinating physics concepts really clearly. But also because she does really interesting work in quantum stuff, which is obviously my wheelhouse.
Yeah.
She's one of those physicists who's sort of willing to ask the difficult questions that the other ones avoid, to the point where her last book was really controversial. So it was called Lost in Math. And it was basically about the dangers of theoretical physicists disappearing up their own assholes with their mathematics. And it got into her a lot of trouble, actually.
Yeah, she's spicy.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
She doesn't mind pissing her colleagues off.
No, she doesn't seem to.
Yeah.
In fact, you know, so I would say she probably enjoys it.
Thrives it.
So, but the, obviously, you know, how fast we can travel is a question that's basically about space flight, isn't it? Because you want to get rid of air resistance. You know, you can travel quite fast on Earth, but you've always got air resistance, and you've always got friction on the ground. So basically, space flight is the way to go the fastest. So the first thing that I ask Sabine is the obvious question. Well, it's obvious to me, a physicist.
Okay. It's going to be loads of this, isn't it? and I'm a physicist, by the way, so I understood that.
Can we just keep pushing the speed of rockets, ideally so that we can travel vast distances through space?
Basically, you move a rocket forward by momentum conservation. You throw out stuff one direction and then the rocket moves the other direction. So you need to have something to throw out. So you need some kind of fuel, some kind of combustion, whatever way you want to do it. And all the current propulsion mechanisms that we know, they only make so much power. So it just takes a really long time to get up to high speeds. And if you want to cross the galaxy, it's going to take a really, really long time, by which I mean, some million years or something. So that's the small pitfall. And then there's the larger problem is the speed of light barrier, which Einstein taught us. You can't accelerate to a velocity above the speed of light. And that seems to be a pretty big problem.
Yeah, there's a few big problems. So we'll start with rockets, which is essentially they're just too heavy and too slow to get us anywhere
rockets
quickly.
Are the basic bitch of spaceflight, aren't they?
Yeah.
In that, like, it's just like we need to escape the Earth's gravitational field, which means you need to reach escape velocity, which is like 7 miles per second. 25,000 miles per hour. So you need something that gives you a big oomph to get you up there.
Can you just explain escape velocity, please?
So escape velocity means that you are traveling at a speed at which the Earth's gravity can't pull you back down again or won't pull you back down again.
So you're not just going to fall back down.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so you're fast enough to get away from that pull. And if you want to stay in orbit around the Earth, you have to... have a certain speed going on. So just outside the atmosphere, it's 17,000 miles per hour. If you want to be much higher in what's called a geosynchronous orbit, so that you end up sort of just hovering over one point on the Earth, that's 7,000 miles per hour you need to be going to sort of balance out the effects of gravity.
Sounds like how you have to whack a satellite up,
yeah,
for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But all of this needs that massive oomph to get you up initially. And basically, we just take a load of explosive and... put it underneath the thing we want to send up and ignite it and channel the burn basically downwards so that Newton's third law takes us upwards. I shouldn't give this to you. You should know this.
Every action has an equal and opposite reaction.
Yes, of course.
Yeah, come on, mate. Behave yourself. I guess that the obvious thing, and perhaps we'll go on and talk about this, I don't know, is that you would ideally want to be taking off from somewhere a bit higher. Do you know what I mean? So if you could have a sort of an intermediate, so I don't know if you could take off from the space station, but something like that, where you can take stuff up, and then when you're trying to push off for your main journey, you don't need to expend so much fuel to escape.
Yeah, because the big problem is, like, a rocket burns a lot of fuel.
Yeah.
Right? So you have to have all this fuel, and of course you have to lift the fuel as well. So the more fuel you have, the heavier the payload, the more energy you need to lift it out of Earth's gravitational field. So what you want is to kind of find a way to do that, and then and this is the whole point of going to Mars, isn't it, and the Moon, really, for people like Musk, is to establish a base from which you can then more easily lift off, and go into interstellar space, the solar system at least.
Effectively. Taking off from the Moon is just that much easier because the Moon's gravitational pull is that much
lower. Yeah. It's sort of quite straightforward.
It does to a layperson, and I'm happy to say that I'm a layperson here. It sort of looks a bit like we had the space race, we got to the Moon, and then just sort of fucked it off. It's like, well, there we go then.
It does. But, I mean, it does feel like that, doesn't it?
Yeah. It's up until very recently, at least.
Yeah, I was going to say, we're quite mad for rockets again now. There's a lot of stuff. Obviously, SpaceX are launching all the time.
Yeah.
You know,
Blue Origin as well.
Blue Origin. There's sort of various programs to get things going. Amazon, actually, this month, so we're recording this in April, just like put in the biggest ever set of orders for rocket launches because they want to establish their own sort of internet links. Like, you know, Musk has done Starlink. Mm-hmm, and Bezos obviously doesn't want to get left behind. So he's now launching loads and loads of satellites. So, you know, we haven't done loads of sending people up anymore, but we have done loads of sort of establishing satellites, you know, and all of the kind of space infrastructure that we rely on in the modern world now. But basically, going, you know, putting humans in space is, you know, it was dramatic and it was great. Sort of at the end of the 60s, and it looked really good, and you know, everyone was up for it. Mm. And then you sort of realize over the next couple of decades, as you do when you see the space shuttle explode, it's just expensive, dangerous, and actually fairly pointless as well.
Yeah,
it doesn't achieve a great deal.
Are you?
No. So
that's not the way to explore space, ultimately.
No, I think the way that we are going to explore space sort of in the long run is going to be more robots. Isn't it? So bigger or better, smarter robots. So, you know, we put robots on Mars and we're starting to see what that's about. But, you know, you can imagine a future where we'll just send robots out into the interstellar space and you know, they'll send us back the information. You don't need to put humans out there, really. You know, and when you've had things...
Sending back the information, you sort of threw that away, but that's not straightforward.
It's not straightforward, no. I mean, that takes
a while to get that information back.
Yeah, it can take a very long time, depending on how far you go. Mm. I mean, Mars, Mars is 20 minutes for communication.
Yeah.
I think the moon is, what, 2 or 3 minutes or something? So, you know, you're going beyond Mars, you know... So
the closest star, is that
Alpha Centauri?
Yeah.
4.3 light years away.
Okay, so that's a message. So you've sent a robot there. It's taken them, by the way, fucking ages to get there.
Especially if they're using a chemical rocket.
Yeah, and they're trying to send a picture back. And that picture will take at least 4 years.
Yeah. Yeah. By which time you've kind of lost interest, haven't you?
Yeah. It moved on to another star.
But I mean, it's interesting because NASA, I think, painted space travel as it was going to be the norm. Like the shuttle was meant to be just like a shuttle. It was meant to just go up and back all the time and sort of make it, you know, sort of routine. And that just never happened. And somebody worked out like what they cost in the end. $1.6 billion per flight, space shuttles.
Yeah, I mean,
it's just mad.
I mean, bear in mind, I get the train from London to Manchester quite often, so I'm not surprised.
Actually, I wonder if mile for mile you're actually paying more.
It certainly feels like it when I can't get a seat and the fucker's delayed.
But I mean, even the International Space Station, we sort of, you know, I as a, you know, science fan want to say that it's a really good thing and it's amazing. And, you know, I watch it going over sometimes and you just think that's an amazing thing that there's humans up there doing stuff. Yeah. They're not doing anything that's particularly useful. Basically,
no, it's all like, can we like grow some potatoes?
Yeah, or grow some crystals.
Yeah,
like school science. It feels a bit school science-y.
Massively, like when you I had a chemistry set that I got from my birthday. Sort of not a great present, actually, looking back on it. Mum and Dad, if you're listening, which you aren't, but yeah, that it's that level of thing. That
yeah,
doing.
And we've learned obviously what happens to the human body in space to a certain degree, and sort of we've learned some.
And it's all such good news.
but you know, the ISS cost $150 billion, right? And I found this quote from Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, who's a science fan, and he says there's no way you could justify the vast sums that have been spent on building the ISS, and the scientific returns have been meager. Oh.
Is he, Martin Rees, the Astronomer Royal, is he one of these people that you've pissed off in the past?
Yeah, yeah. Well, not too long ago in the past, to be honest.
Yeah,
I don't know if he's talking to me.
I can't remember. What happened?
It was the LIGO thing.
Yes, it was the LIGO thing.
Yeah. I don't really want to get into that now.
No, fine. But just suffice to say that the world is littered with physicists that Brooksy has pissed off. And I love it. So what about... we said so. If you're sending a chemical rocket any distance, well, first of all, you probably just aren't. But if you are, it's taking so fucking long.
Yeah, I mean, ridiculous amounts of time.
What are our other options?
So, one of the options, so there was this Russian high-tech billionaire whose accounts have probably been frozen back now, Yuri Milner. So he put out a sort of initiative in 2016 to like look at future propulsion and, you know, what could we do? And one of the things that's come out of that is solar sailing. Yeah, so more solar sailing ideas. So the idea is basically you put up a big sail, and instead of wind, obviously because there's no wind in space, you use light and you fire a laser at it, and the laser bouncing off the sail effectively pushes it forward.
So one sort of mirrored surface to the sail.
Yeah, but it has to be obviously very light and very flexible because you've got to get up there in the first place and then unfold it. And I mean, the James Webb Space Telescope that's just gone up, that's got a solar sail on it. So you can do this, and there's a plan to kind of to put out something that they the engineers behind it think can reach 1/5 of the speed of light, which is pretty good.
That's rapid. That is rapid. Yeah.
Right. But the trouble is that thing is like basically the size of a microchip. So, you know, with a huge sail on it. So how big is the sail? The sail is like 3 meters wide, about 10 foot wide, they said. So that has to be unfolded from this thing.
It's not too bad.
But it's
like a little Pac-Mac.
Yeah, effectively. But you've got to shine a laser on it from Earth. So you've got to keep it tracked, sort of.
That feels like a big challenge.
Yeah. But they're saying, you know, it's feasible that you can do this. And that gets you to about 1/5 the speed of light. But it's only the size of a microchip. You know, you're not catching a ride on that. So none of us are going to travel at 1/5 of the speed of light of these things.
But I guess, you know, we would be able to fit, a camera, you know, and some form of little AI on there, wouldn't you?
Yeah, but what we're really interested in is how fast can we travel?
Yeah, rather than how fast can we get something to travel? Okay.
So and the basic problem is that everything has mass, and mass slows you down. So
because are you going to get relativistic effects at 1/5 of the speed of light?
Yeah, you will. Yeah.
So that little microchip is going to
it's going to have
a greater mass.
Yeah. Yeah, it will. I mean, it's not going to be huge at 1/5 of the speed of light.
Yeah.
But, you know, the whole problem that we have is that we want to go fast, but we have mass, and that's sort of a problem.
It'll really slow you down, isn't it? Carry on.
Just ignore that. Fat shaming. and so you have to do something about that, because basically mass increases as you get faster and faster. That's sort of relativity.
Yeah. Not something you have to worry about. But
you haven't seen me yet. I don't know. Sometimes, you know, going past a defender, you think, wow, his mass really must have gone up there. So you have to do something that kind of gets you out of that problem. And one of the solutions that's coming up is a thing, you'll heard it, warp drive.
Yes.
And it used to be that people talked about it as, you know, ridiculous science fiction, can't be done, lots of problems to it. But actually, you know, when you examine the relativistic stuff from it, you can maybe do something with it.
So the definition of a warp drive is just something that will allow you to break that speed limit, the speed of light, yeah?
In theory. This is something that I asked Sabine to explain.
So the idea with a warp drive is that you get from one place to another, not by moving through space, but by deforming the space around you. And the reason that people get excited about it is that if you know a little bit at least about general relativity, it's not a priori completely crazy, because we know that the speed of light limit really only applies to objects moving in space. It doesn't apply to space itself. So we are pretty sure, you know, both from the mathematics and also partly from our observations, that space itself can deform and expand faster than the speed of light.
Yeah, I think she might have lost some people when she said, yeah, as long as you've got, you know, sort of like rudimentary understanding of general relativity. I guess that counts quite a lot of people out.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, this is where
I think
it does,
I'm just about it clinging on.
Does get a bit more sciencey at this point.
Good, good. I think if that's the case, then it might be time for me to just psych myself up and get a cup of tea. But we'll be right back after this quick break to discuss what it would feel like to move at the speed of light, wormholes, and of course we'll be asking today's expert, Sabine Hossenfelder, to answer today's question: what's the fastest we'll ever be able to travel?
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds. And they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weight loss. That's PlushCare.com/weight loss. PlushCare.com/weight loss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
And we're back. Now, where were we? Oh, we're about to get quite science-y.
So I'm going to blow your mind. Okay. And I mean, so we want to be able to move faster than the speed of light. Yep. I mean, that would be ideal for our, you know, can we, what's the fastest we can ever travel?
Well, and if you're going to get anywhere, like realistically, you're going to get anywhere interesting, you need to start picking up the pace.
Yeah. So, I mean, so relativity tells us if you accelerate towards the speed of light, your mass increases, which makes it harder and harder for you to accelerate anymore. So as you approach the speed of light, you basically run out of energy. It takes an infinite amount of energy to go any faster.
Yeah.
And that's why you've got this limit. But that limit only applies to things with mass. Now, if you take the thing that we call space-time, so, you know, the three dimensions of space we live in, and the time, obviously, that we go through. Yeah. Einstein put these together into this four-dimensional thing called space-time. Mm-hmm. And this is what the universe is made of. And this doesn't have to obey that limit because it doesn't have mass. So basically what a warp drive does is you take something with mass, like me, and you cloak it inside a bubble of space-time. Mm. And then that space-time itself can move faster than the speed of light with you inside of it. So basically what you do is you use energy, and this is now we're getting into general relativity.
Mm.
You use energy to deform space-time. So everything that has mass or energy deforms space-time a little bit. So around the Earth, the gravitational field of the Earth is basically because the space and time around the Earth is deformed by the Earth's mass. That's what the gravitational field is.
Yeah, so it's sort of like it looks like a well, if you like.
Yeah,
so stuff sort of rolls.
The classic is the sort of bowling ball on the trampoline, isn't it? And it sort of creates this deformation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so we can do that just, you know, if we get a whole lump of energy or mass, we can deform the space-time behind us so that we actually stretch it out, which sort of pushes us forward. And we use the same kind of thing to deform the space-time in front of us, where we want to go.
Yeah.
And you try and just squash it. So you can imagine like a slinky spring
extends
behind you and then contracts in front of you.
Yeah.
And then
a bit like watching like a leech move.
Yeah. That same sort of compression and elongation.
Yeah.
And that basically, so it's not strictly, I mean, I was sort of thinking about this, it's not strictly within our definition of moving fast, because what you're doing is moving the destination towards you, effectively. But I'm going to let that slide, because I sort of think it works anyway.
And the upshot is that you end up at a place that is really far away.
Yeah. So you have moved
in less time. So I think
fast.
It works. Yeah.
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 It's maybe slightly.
I think you've got to allow it.
Yeah. Yeah.
So has anyone designed anything that could do this?
Yeah. So, I mean, lots of science fiction writers have talked about this kind of thing. Because obviously, ever since Einstein came up with it, people sort of said, what could we do that? But actually, in 1994, a Mexican physicist called Miguel Albuquerque, I think my accent there was more Italian than Mexican, maybe.
I think the bigger problem was that's probably not his name, but yeah. I've always said like Alcubierre.
Alcubierre. What did I say? Alcubierre?
Yeah, I don't know what I mean.
Yeah.
It sounded exotic. I'll give you that.
Yeah. Anyway, so this Mexican physicist came up with a way of doing faster than light travel, he sort of showed how you could do it. So how you take the equations of general relativity and you impose a big sort of distortion through mass or an energy, and that gives you the ability to kind of compress and extend space-time to give you that kind of fast movement through the universe inside this little bubble of space-time that you're in.
But is it in any way practical? Like, is it something that someone could look at and go, okay, yeah, I've got an idea how to build that?
Yeah, it's tricky.
It's a no, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a no. So this is theoretical physicists dicking about with ideas on blackboards, effectively. Yeah. One of the issues with the Mexican guy's scheme was that you need negative energy. So if you want to go faster than light, which you can do in theory, you need something called negative energy to distort the space and time in the way that it needs to be distorted to make that happen.
What's negative energy?
Nobody really knows. I mean, it's sort of a mathematical idea rather than a physical thing. So nobody's ever seen negative energy. We don't know how to create it. What happens is space-time is like rubber. So it's like it's got this tension, like a stretching elastic band. So if you want to stretch it, you have to put sort of energy in like you have to normally do it. But in the way it works, you have to put this negative amount of energy in. So it's almost like compressing it. No, to compress and contract and extend it requires this negative energy. So it's a problem, right? Yeah. Engineering-wise, that's quite tricky.
So without negative energy, this is a non-starter? I mean, is anyone looking at negative energy and thinking, well, maybe we can create this somehow?
Yes, they are. They weren't until recently, but literally in the last couple of years, there's been 3 or 4 papers come out that have actually shown new ways to sort of maybe get around the problem slightly. So this is what I asked Sabine to talk me through.
I should probably first clarify that it's still a really, really small group of people who's working on this. Like, if you look at the grand scheme of things, it's maybe 1 or 2 dozen people. And they don't work on it full time because there aren't really any research programs. So it's a really new thing. And my understanding at the moment is that this issue with the negative energies is still there. And I don't think anyone has a solution to it. But that's only for what faster than light warp drives are concerned. If you're fine staying below the speed of light, you don't necessarily have this problem. And now, some people may find this a little bit disappointing. You know, what's a warp drive if you can't go faster than the speed of light? On the other side, if you think about the problem that you started from, how can we go beyond the current propulsion mechanisms of spaceship rockets that we have today, then if you could at least get up to the speed of light, that would be pretty cool already.
Yeah, it's slightly disappointing.
Really? I'm not disappointed by it at all.
No, but immediately when we're talking about, we'll be able to break the sort of fundamental speed limit of the universe, you're like, cool. And then immediately we're like, well, maybe we'll just go a little bit slower still.
But, I mean, if we can get somewhere near
the
speed limit of the universe,
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
we're a species that, like walks at 4 miles an hour. We run maybe at 6 or 8. It's like, this is significant achievement.
All right.
You know, a few hundred years ago, the fastest thing we were moving on was sort of, you know, donkeys, horses.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't huge. And now we're talking about getting close to being able to achieve the fundamental speed limit of the universe. So wind your neck in.
Yes, I'll take your point. But it's not a warp drive then, is it?
It is still a warp drive because it still uses exactly the same...
definition of a warp drive was faster than the speed of light.
No. Right? So the warp drive is just something
about
that uses
space-time.
A warping space-time. Okay, yeah. So the idea is that actually you can have positive energy that will warp it enough to get you sort of close to the speed of light. I have to say, I mean, you need a lot of this energy, very concentrated. So apparently it's something like, if you had something the mass of an aeroplane, say, and you wanted to move it to the speed of light, you would need something like a third of the energy that's in the mass of the sun.
Okay.
And I'm not sure how the mass of the aeroplane is like carrying all of that anyway. So there are engineering issues to overcome but it doesn't require negative energy. So, I mean, which automatically makes it really, really sort of unphysical, if you like. But if you can use positive energy to warp space-time and get close to the speed of light, I think that's, you know, that's quite a significant thing to be able to work on. And, you know, these papers are published in good journals. You know, the maths is pretty sound. And so, you know, what we've sort of established is that, like, okay, this is not impossible now.
Can I ask what might be a slightly disrespectful question? The people who are studying this stuff or working in a field like this, like, I imagine there's not many of them. It's obviously very niche because fundamentally we sort of know nothing's ever going to come of it, I think. So is it just like a hobby?
It's exactly like that. I mean, it is just a hobby because...
So they're sort of doing other stuff, but then they're like, but this is quite fun.
Yeah, but that's okay. It's like...
Yeah, no, it is. I was just wondering.
It's like if you're a professional footballer, right?
Like, who the fuck's funding that?
Nobody's funding it, right?
No.
But if you're a professional footballer, you're not really paid to, like, get really good at doing keepy uppies, say.
Yeah.
But on a training field, you might just sort of entertain yourself.
Yeah.
And it gives you a set of skills that might come in useful in a game. At some point, you know, you've got some extra things. So I sort of think of this as the kind of keepy-uppy of theoretical physics, where you're just messing about with stuff and seeing what comes out.
And the guys at, like, the Jet Propulsion Lab, NASA's Jet Propulsion Lab, like, they're probably fiddling around with this stuff, aren't they? And they
probably
are
in their spare time.
You reckon they wouldn't be doing it sort of on the company dime?
Well, I mean, who am I to say? I mean, of course they are. Everybody messes around on the company dime, don't they?
Yeah.
But the point is, you know, all this stuff is there sort of coming from the Einstein's equations, the general relativity equations. So you're just playing around with those. And of course, you know, one afternoon you might sort of mess about with, you know, can I do warp drives as a distraction from something else you're doing? And it just helps you sort of, you know, maybe gives you skills, math skills, I don't know, just to...
Be able to use
somewhere else. So it's not a terrible thing. It's like Stephen Hawking used to say that, you know, you mess around with like trying to invent time travel because it's kind of fun to do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not a bad way to sort of spark the imagination. And that can lead you to other places.
I get it. It's you know, intellectual curiosity and it's quite fun. But probably
I'm not saying, you know, that they should be like funded full time to, you know, have an institute of warp drives or anything like that.
There is, though. Isn't there a guy who used to work at the Jet Propulsion
Hal Puthoff.
Yeah, didn't he set up a...
Yeah, it was the Advanced Propulsion Lab or something, wasn't it?
I think it was called. But that's
they
what
never
they
produced
were doing.
Anything that anybody really had any sort of belief in at all.
Yeah.
Which is why, you know, you should just mess around with these things.
Yeah, it's a good hobby to have.
Yeah.
Here's a question. What would it... I realise that we're saying this is probably not going to happen, but what would it feel like and what would it look like to move at the speed of light?
So amazingly, if you were just moving in a straight line at the speed of light, it would just feel like riding an aeroplane or something that was moving in a straight line at much less speed. So, because speed isn't the thing that makes you feel anything, right? So you don't have any, it's acceleration that you feel. So moving at the speed of light, you would actually just feel nothing in particular.
I'd feel a bit excited.
You'd be looking at the dial in front of you, wouldn't you, say, oh, we're nearly there. But, I mean, you would see things. So everything that's coming towards you would basically turn blue. All the light turns blue because it's blue shifted by the Doppler effect.
Yeah.
And look behind you and it's
red.
Red. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you got that. You're also probably dead because all of the particles that were going through space at a reasonable speed are now coming at you very, very hard.
Uh-huh.
So there's that. And then I mean, it doesn't quite work because the maths is incredibly complicated and not this simple. But basically, if you travelled at 99.5% of the speed of light for 5 years and then came back to Earth, you would find that you'd come back. Say you left on Christmas Day this year,
yeah.
You would come back on Christmas Day 2082, because your clock, your internal clock, slows down relative to Earth. So much more time passes on Earth than passes
for you. Yeah.
Although it doesn't quite work like that, because if you turn in a circle, then you're accelerating and you're changing reference frames, to be technical and stuff. But it's a kind of nice sort of idea that if you travel close to the speed of light, you actually alter your perception of time. And
well, so time relative really to, slows down.
Yeah, you don't know that.
You don't realize
until you go back again and you realize that you've basically traveled into the future.
And would you be aware that your mass had gone up? No.
No, not, you know, as long as you're not sort of being accelerated.
Yeah.
Basically, no. So, you know, it's kind of, you know, interesting.
Just getting up to speed is the
and you're probably, I mean, if you're not going up in a rocket, you're probably not getting into a warp drive, are you?
Of course I'm not, absolutely nowhere near. I've read a bit about various ways that we might be able to sort of get around the universe a bit quicker, and one of the things that sometimes comes up is wormholes.
Oh yeah.
And
yeah.
Black holes,
yeah,
as sort of almost just like shortcuts to other bits of the universe.
Yeah, again, it's like this sort of cheating
thing.
It's a cheat,
yeah. You haven't
really
actually travelled the distance. You've just ended up...
You found a little cut through.
Yeah.
So this was one of the things I asked Sabine about. Basically, you know, are warp drives the only option, or are there other sort of physics-based answers to travelling fast through space?
The thing is, if you look at the theories that we currently have, in the foundations of physics, all the stuff that we know about particles and quantum physics and space and time and so on, it's probably pretty much the only option. I mean, there are people talking about wormholes, and we can talk about wormholes, but the thing with the wormholes is you don't actually know how to create them. Again, there's the issue with the negative energies that you need. But also, once you've created them, they don't remain stable and so on. However, we also know that the theories we currently have are incomplete, so general relativity can't actually be ultimately the correct theory. We need some way to combine it with quantum mechanics, so we need this theory of quantum gravity is what it's called, and we don't actually know what this theory looks like, so maybe there are other ways to travel hidden within this theory that we haven't yet figured out.
Well, I mean, this is a classic case of calm your boner, Brooksy, because this is so in your sweet spot. Talk about quantum mechanics and gravity. You're in your element.
Well, I mean, the physics is central to this issue, isn't it? So,
yes.
So let me, I'll just expand a little bit.
Have your moment.
So wormholes, I mean, wormholes have this problem. They are basically a rip in space-time. So you kind of, the idea is that you rip it open, and then you can tunnel through to another region of space-time where there's also another rip. So ideally, you know, you can travel through time that way, but you can also travel through space. It's just literally, it could be a shortcut. The only problem is it's very difficult to rip space-time open. You need a massive amount of energy. And to keep it open requires negative energy. So we're back to that problem of negative energy again.
Mm-hmm.
Bit tricky, but, you know, you can certainly find sources of massive amounts of energy, like black holes.
But also, what about just finding a wormhole? So not creating your own, but just like looking for could we find a wormhole and then pop through that?
Yeah, easily done. I mean, the problem is that they shouldn't exist, really, because although theoretically, you know, you can imagine that they could exist.
Have we spotted one?
No. There's no understanding of them at all. You can imagine that the catastrophic sort of intensity of energy around a black hole could rip space-time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's the whole point of it. Like, you go into a black hole, and that there at the singularity, the heart of a black hole, is a rip in space-time. So you can imagine that maybe you could travel into a black hole find the singularity and then pop out the other side and you're somewhere else in the universe. But wormholes just sitting there, sort of not with black holes attached to them, which, you know, have their own issues for travel. They just don't exist as far as we know. And because we know that it would require sort of this negative energy to keep them open, and we don't think negative energy is a physical thing in the universe, we suspect that there's no such thing as a wormhole. But we don't have all the answers, right?
So we really don't.
Yeah. We don't know what the final description of the universe that we come up with is going to look like. So we've got quantum physics, which describes some properties of black holes, and relativity describes others, but those two theories are incomplete, or they don't sort of bind together properly. It's like one of them is made of Meccano and the other one's Lego, and you can't put them together.
And because quantum basically is for really, 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 really small scale stuff, and relativity is for really, really big scale stuff.
Yeah.
And you just can't, we can't marry them up, but we need some kind of quantum gravity theory, and we don't have it.
We don't have it. We have some candidates, the strongest of which might be string theory, which you'll have heard of, where everything's made of sort of bundles of energy. But it's not a very complete theory. A lot of physicists say it's complete nonsense. It requires, you know, lots of... it requires us to have like 10 extra dimensions in the universe.
That we can't see.
Sorry, 7 extra dimensions that we can't see.
And they're sort of folded in somewhere. It's all a bit...
Yeah, they call them
compactified. It feels very mathematical, doesn't it?
Yeah, so it is all very mathematical. Mm. And the other problem is that testing that theory, you know, like we test the standard model of particle physics at the LHC and we bang particles together, you know, and you need a really big particle accelerator to do that. If you want to test string theory, it only really applies at the high energies that you'd get from an accelerator that was basically the size of a galaxy. So, you know, funding, tricky again.
It's quite good. The other day on the radio show that I do, we had your mate, I think, is he called John Butterworth?
Yeah.
Is that his name? Yeah. Who works at the LHC. At the LHC, or has worked at the LHC.
Didn't call me again then.
No, not this time. And we were just talking about the fact they're switching it back on.
Yeah.
And I was talking to him, and then dark matter came up, and Rachel, entirely reasonably, just said to him, "Hold on, what is dark matter then?" And it was genuinely quite embarrassing, because of course he's just like, we don't know. We don't really know what. And she's like, but it's like most of the. Makes up most of the universe. It's like, yeah. But you don't know what it is.
Next question.
No. I really enjoyed it, though.
Yeah, I mean, there is a lot that we don't know. So we can't rule out that we'll find some way of basically, you know, moving fast through the universe, you know, finding shortcuts, whatever. I mean, it seems unlikely, but, you know.
But not in, yeah, not.
They said planes would never fly.
Yeah, I guess so. But the laws of physics didn't say that planes couldn't fly.
I think some people interpreted the laws of physics as saying, actually, you can't have planes.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
So just, I know this is a sort of, I'm just trying to think of a way of explaining what a wormhole is, even though we don't know if they necessarily exist and have never seen one, etc. But in that kind of model of space-time, where you just imagine it as sort of being a rubber mat, if it's so deformed that it's kind of it's bent round, so you sort of almost like fold it in half, then there's going to be a point where two different sides sort of touch, and that's a sort of explanation of what a wormhole could be. And obviously, if you're, because you're confined to the plane of the rubber mat, so as you're traveling, If you weren't using a wormhole, you would just travel in a straight line and eventually end up at the place, and you wouldn't realise that it was bent.
Yes,
at all. Yeah. There's no way of knowing that. But that's the sort of shortcut.
Yeah. So it's like where two bits touch, and then, you know, if you can rip them together, so then you've got a shortcut. Rather than travelling around the whole outside of the loop,
which would take, you know, forever.
Yeah.
Effectively.
Yeah. Far too long.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. So given that. Wormholes and black holes and quantum gravity are all sort of essentially unknowns. They're not providing us with any way of travelling particularly fast through the universe. So I suppose we're back at warp drives as being the best possibility for getting much, much faster than a rocket.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you know, solar sails, we talked about, sort of, you know, they might...
But we're not going to be...
We're not going to be on them, really.
No.
And they're not going to take us where as fast as we want to go. So if you're looking for the ultimate limit,
like a hang glider as well, you'd feel like a
you'd be like a windsurfer in space, wouldn't you? How embarrassing!
What's Brooksy doing? Oh God, he's strapped on the light sail again. He looks like an absolute Burke.
And why is he wearing a wetsuit?
That's actually that's a full body girdle.
So we've got warp drives, we've got solar sails, we've got options. Who knows what we'll get to in the future? But I asked Sabine about where we might see ourselves, and she seemed reasonably positive about getting at least doing better than chemical rockets.
I definitely think we'll eventually be able to do better than space rockets with advanced propulsion mechanisms, new technology. We'll be able to travel faster, more energy efficiently, provided we don't go extinct before we develop that.
So yeah, I mean, she started off quite optimistic and then obviously mentioned the extinction of the human race.
She has a point though, doesn't she?
Yeah, she does. She does. I mean, I'm sort of broadly for it.
What, the extinction of the human race? I mean, can you give us a little moment to go post-human first? So I think we should be sending robots out into space, right?
Yeah.
And I think it's possible that we'll be able to send basically cyborgs or engineered humans eventually. And I know I'm sounding a bit like Elon Musk here, but I think it's a reasonable future to look at. You know, when you think of like the augmentations we're able to do at the moment, you know, maybe, you know, maybe in a couple of hundred years time, we'll actually be able to send engineered, reinforced humans that are sort of cyborg-ish into space, and maybe they'll be able to survive a long journey. We'll be able to establish something, and then we can go extinct on Earth.
Well, I know that, you know, something that we've spoken about before on the podcast is the fact that realistically, the most likely interaction you'll ever have with an alien life form will be digital in some way.
Yeah.
Because biological entities traveling that distance just doesn't seem plausible.
Yeah.
That we couldn't survive. Like it's wildly inhospitable in the first instance.
Yeah.
But also just the time involved. No matter how fast you're traveling.
Yeah.
Well, that's not quite true, but within how fast we think we're ever going to be able to travel, you just need to have something that you can just turn off and then it automatically comes on when you arrive.
Yeah.
So a sort of digital consciousness would be it.
Yeah.
And I suppose that's...
us not quite going extinct.
Yeah, yeah. It's us sort of evolving ourselves into something really creepy.
I'll take that.
Yeah. We should do an episode about consciousness.
Yes, like, we should.
About time we got stuck into that again.
That'll be a long argument. One.
Yeah, it will.
Eureka is a Stack production presented by Dr. Michael Brooks and Rick Edwards. The production team is Temi Adebayo, Katie Baxter, Luke Moore and Charlie Morgan. Sound design by Katie Baxter. Special thanks to today's expert, Sabine Hossenfelder. If you like the show, which let's face it, you did, please subscribe and rate wherever you listen to your podcast. It does make a massive difference. You can also find us on Twitter at EurekaPod. Thanks very much.
Eureka is a Stack production and part of the Acast Creator Network.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.